All right, so it is Friday, April 22nd, 2022. I'm Jess from Our Retailer, and I am here with Phyllis and Ted Noggle at their beautiful home out here in Caledonia. We're on the Morrill County side now, right?
Right.
In Morrill County. This is an interview for the Caledonia Public Square Memories and Futures Project that I'm doing with the Village of Caledonia, and it's an honor to interview you guys. Just for the record, can I have you guys say and spell your full names? I think I've got them right, but...
Phyllis, P-H-Y-L-L-I-S, N-O-G-G-L-E.
And Ted, Teddy, T-E-D-D-Y-N-O-G-G-L-E.
And to just start us off, can I have you both just tell me, if you want to, where and when you were born, just to give us some context for where you're coming from in the world.
I was born in Marion County on September the 18th, 1944.
I was born in Marion and... November 5th, 1943.
So, I don't know who wants to start first, but I'd love to hear from both of you a little bit about your family and your childhood and the world you grew up in. Who wants to start first? So, tell me about where you grew up and the family or community you came out of.
Well, I grew up over on 309 where the highway went over the railroad tracks between Iberia and Caledonia. I grew up in that little house down off the hill. And they went through Daddy's farm. And that's where I grew up at. Went to Marshall School until River Valley consolidated. And then in my junior year, went to Caledonia. That's where I met him.
What about you, Ted? Tell me about the world you came out of.
I was raised right just down the road here by Canaan Church, and lived there. That's where I grew up, and that's where we're on the corner of the farm that my parents owned. We built this house here, and I went to Caledonia School, and we were the last year before they moved into the River Valley building, 1961.
We were the last year.
Yeah. I was next last year. They were the last year.
So you did your schooling at Martell and then got shipped over to Caledonia. You did it all at Caledonia.
I did it all at Caledonia.
But we had graduated before they went to River Valley.
What was it like at that time? Because this is something that's come up in the interview so far in terms of what changed Caledonia. What was it like having your school in town, in Caledonia, at that time?
It was just local, you know. We used to, when you were in high school, we liked to slip out if we could, instead of eating at the school, while we'd go up to the restaurant, maybe, and grab a bite to eat real quick. Or in the back of, now it's the camouflage, but it was then Dick's Bar, I think, and we'd get to slip in the back door and grab a sandwich there. But it was just a community, tight community, and everybody knew everybody, and like they used to say, everybody knows everybody, you can't get away with anything.
What did your family, your parents, whoever raised you, what did they do for a living?
My father worked at a telephone company in Marion, and he spent 45 years with them, and started out riding a bicycle installing telephones. And then this was his hobby. This 50-acre farm was his hobby. He always called it his golf course. When all of his friends were playing golf, he was out here working on the farm. And my mother was a housewife, and she helped with the farming and the livestock.
And your family had been in this area for a while?
Right. All my life.
What about you, Phyllis, on your side? Who raised you and what did they do to make ends meet?
Well, I grew up with my mom and dad and my siblings, and Daddy worked for Marion Power Shovel, And he was one of them that was on the ground floor of making the rocket
shuttle
that was down in Florida. He was on the ground floor of helping to get that shuttle built so they could send it out into space.
The crawler.
Yeah. My mom, she worked some for my Uncle Ellis Oiler that had the greenhouse in Marion on Fairground Street. And he had, he grew his own plants, and my mom would go in and help him do that. But, yeah, we grew up on the farm, and cows and chickens and sheep. And yeah.
So when you guys were growing up, you said you graduated high school in what year?
62
was when I went to River Valley. You're 61. So tell me about the public square in downtown Caledonia when you're a teenager. So late 50s, early 60s. What was happening on the public square?
I wasn't there.
Oh, you were only there the last year.
Right.
So you didn't go into Caledonia that much.
No. Nope. Daddy worked nights, and we did our shopping in Marion, and he would see that we got what we needed.
And you were, you went to Martel schools. You were out in the country, but Martel was probably more substantial at that time. It probably had its own little shops and stuff.
And that school was still standing. It's owned by Dave Swan. Yeah. Interesting, yeah. And that's the only county school left from the River Valley.
Only building left.
Oh, the only building left from what made up River Valley.
So you grew up, did you guys go into Caledonia more?
Well, I grew up, there was the Shell filling station on the corner. And then you had Stickles Market, Reese's Market, and you had Garber's little place across the street. And I'm trying to think of Armbruster had the restaurant, and Pearl and Jack had Mays Hardware. Cy Baker had the, and Bob Longacre had the Mechanics Garage. And that was basically right there. There was on the corner there, the buildings was, they called drugstore. And can't think of Harold last owner of the drugstore before it closed as a drugstore.
Was it Shockley?
Well, Shockley.
It was Kelly, then Shockley, then Walmart.
Yeah, right. And then years later, it became a pizza. Merv Stafford had it. And other than that, when I was real young, the middle location of the two stores there was a dry goods shop. It was a lady that had like children's clothes and things like that. But I remember that very little.
What about Kazoo? Left Kazoo had the filling station on the highway.
Yeah, before that, yeah.
What about the building that became your flower shop? Do you remember what was in? Was that a barber shop?
Well, when I was growing up, the Legion had that building, and I went there to Boy Scout meeting. And that's the only thing that I remember that building being, but we were told that there was a barber shop there at one time. There was a fix-it shop there. I don't know what all was in there, but that basically was it.
What did you guys do, either as kids or in your teenagers? I know you didn't go into Caledonia much, but maybe think about that last year of high school. What kind of cultural activities were there to do as 17, 18-year-olds in Caledonia. Were there a lot of channels for that, or did people go to Marion to hang out?
Ball games. School competition.
Friday night, we'd go to, if we weren't going to a ball game, we would catch the bus and go to the roller rink and go skating there on the edge of Marion.
So there was a bus to Marion?
Well, there was the roller rink owned a bus, and they would come out and pick up, they would go to Martell and to the school area there and pick up some kids, and then come back into Caledonia and pick up kids and go over. And that's, they did that on Friday, I think it was Friday nights.
That's service. Wow.
Yeah. But,
do you guys want to tell me how you met in high school? If it's not too scandalous, it's up to you.
He was a
librarian,
and I sat in the front row, and I could see him in the
library.
In the library.
So you graduated and then stayed to be a librarian afterwards?
No, I was librarian first period study hall, and the study hall and the room in front of it was the library, and they staffed it by different students, and I had the first period in my senior year. I had the library in my first period. And that's how we met.
Well, I don't know if you want this on your recording.
It's up to you. I don't know what you're going to say. Do you want me to pause it, or are you going to keep going?
He had three open heart surgeries. He was a blue baby. Had three open heart surgeries in grade school. And they had told his parents that he might live till he was 13, maybe 20. He will be 79 this year. And Children's Hospital tells us he is the oldest blue baby they have living on record. And he had a pulmonary valve put in, and they told us when he had that done, maybe he would do 8 to 10 years on that, and they might have to do it again. So I mentioned it to his heart doctor, Dr. Daniels, last September, and he said, yeah, that's right. And I said, it's been 20 years, and they tell us that pulmonary valve is still good. And he just grinned and said, he's the exception.
Wow, that's amazing. You're a miracle.
Yes, he is. That's the biggest miracle of our life, is the fact that he's still here and got grandkids and great-grandkids and has a legacy.
Was that a weight on you in high school with that kind of, you know, with Dr. Son, you might not make it? That sounds horrible.
I really, you know, never knew, or I guess never entered my mind type thing. I wasn't allowed to, I couldn't play sports and stuff because I couldn't take the exercise and stuff. I used to go in gym class, but, I was limited there, what I could do and stuff, but I knew my limits, and that's, as far as I'm concerned, I lived a fairly normal life.
Yeah.
And was very seldom sick. Maybe I got a case of the flu once ever winter, about the end of February, and good old Doc Axel would give me a shot of penicillin and give me some pills and send me home. And he was the one that got my parents to get me to a doctor in Cleveland, which is well known, Dr. Beck, and he was the one that did my three surgeries as a child, second, fifth, and seventh grade. And then I had a surgery at the age of 36, at Cleveland Clinic. And then in 2003 or 4 is when I had the pulmonary valve.
2002. So. Breaking the records. Yeah. So for both of you guys, I always like to ask people to think back to this moment, kind of end of high school. What did you each want to do with your lives? What did you think you would do for a living? What did you want to do next? Do you want me to pause it for the phone, too? So while Ted's on the phone, so tell me about, yeah, when you were 17, 18, what were you interested in, and what did you want to do with the rest of your life at that moment, if you can think back?
The only thing, I grew up in a Christian home, and I wanted to do what God had planned for me. And so it's been a very interesting life how he has used me over all of these years just from one thing to another. And when I was about 9, somebody had given my mom and dad a piano, and there was no money for piano lessons back then. And I learned to play by ear. And then when I was in high school, and Mrs. Bailey was directing the course, I made myself learn to read music. But when I was about 9, the Climax Church down the road here, they needed a piano player, and all I knew was 2 songs. And they were happy because they had a piano player, but I made myself learn to play other songs for them. And I have been... I don't know how many churches, even when we were in Dallas, and I played down there, and they wanted to know if I would take charge of the children's moments on Monday morning, and they called me Miss Chapel. The children called me Miss Chapel, because that's what they called that time I was there with the kids. There was 120. I made all their costumes for 2 programs during the year. And they told me when we left, they had closed down the children's because they were having problems being able to get directors and stuff like that, and they closed it down. They said there was about 800 costumes they gave to the children's little theater that I had made. But the first time I was ever hired, a year ago, it'll be 2 years in November, at the Edison Church, because I was just going wherever, whoever needed me to play. They'd call and say, can you come play? And yeah.
So you're with the Edison Church now.
And the Edison United Methodist Church called me and wanted to know if I'd come play, and I said, sure. So I did, and they said, can you come next Sunday? And I said, yeah. And then in the middle of the week, they called and said, the board met in your heart. I've been there ever since, but I'm playing also for Channel 39 because Carolyn and Dave both passed away, and Carolyn played for their service at 1 o'clock. And so Jonathan, that lives right up the road here, their son, he got left to manage that, and it's nationwide. And so I am going in there and playing a lot on Sundays at 1 o'clock after I leave Edison. Get a bite to eat, and I go to Channel 39. But it's on television, it's on iPods, it's all over the United States and Canada.
Do you guys need to talk about your call, or are you good?
Yeah, that was...
So, Phyllis, it sounds like you tried to just, because of your faith, just be open.
Just listen to where God, and I've directed, when you have kids and you have kids in the church, teenagers, and what did we call it? I don't even remember. They just needed a director, and they had kids things going on, and they just needed a director to guide them. And
like a youth ministry.
Right. Yeah. I don't know what we called it. But yeah.
And did you start doing work in the church right after high school, or did you go to work after high school?
Yeah, I worked at the first place I worked at was Fulfillment, yeah. And then I went from Fulfillment to Central Soya, and I ran their teletype and switchboard.
That was a soybean company.
Yeah. Right there on Fairground, yeah. And until we got married, and then I raised kids and taught myself how to do arrangements. And
so you didn't start off training to be a florist. That came later.
I never trained to be a florist. I have never trained to be anything in my life. It was just like, you know, if you're going to do it, God gives you the system to know what to do. And I liked flowers, and we got to be such a big business. And it was just, you know, we might have weddings, 2 or 3 on the weekend, and it's like, oh, I'm just about burnt out on this. But we kept going, and when we went to Dallas, then our daughter took it over, Tanya, the one that's at NAP Insurance. She took it over and kept it going for a couple of years, but I was too far away to have hands on what was actually going on. And that was when your grandpa decided that he wanted to buy the building.
And
we sold it to Jack and Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll catch us back up to you guys founding the family florist. But Ted, tell me, what happened to you after graduation from high school? What did you want to do, and what did you do?
After I graduated, I went to, due to my health and stuff and things, I was going to become an accountant. And I went to Marion Business College. And while I was at Marion Business College, I would go in the morning there, and then at noon, I'd go to work part-time for Henry's Forest, do deliveries, and take care of what we call the accounts receivable. When she'd hand me, like, money that had come in from checks and stuff that had come in, payments, and I would take care of logging those in and stuff for her.
So you worked for Trella.
I worked for Trella. And then I decided accounting wasn't my thing totally. And I went up to, and then I went to work for Servex Electronics. And I worked for Charlie Sims for 3.5-4 years. And that was, in that time, we got married and stuff. And then I left there and went to work for General Telephone and did installation of new equipment in central offices and stuff like that. Traveled around the state doing that for them for a while. And then they asked me to go into the repair center on Leader Street in Marion for GTE, and I took that over and worked there until they asked me to go up to engineering, and I went up to engineering and took over a project up there that they wanted me to do, and then from then on I stayed in engineering. I spent 26 years at GTE. And in that time, the last 5 years or so, I went on a project that they had, and I went to Chicago and spent 8 months up there working on a project, and I would travel back and forth every other weekend. And I had an apartment up there and lived up there and come home. And then I come back to Marion, worked for here at Marion until GTE decided they wanted to downsize. And I took early retirement. I spent 2 years, a year and a half or so, going from one thing to another. I worked part-time for nursing home in Marion. Plus, I work part-time for an electrician in Marion. And then I got a call one day from a contract company wanting me to go to work for Citizens Communication in Dallas, Texas. They wanted me to clock there for 3 months and do some work. And because of my background with GTE, and I went out there, and they kept extending my contract. Finally, Citizens hired me, and that's how we stayed. We bought a house and stayed, and she moved out to Dallas. And then I spent 6 years, well, all together, it was pretty near 8 years with out there, and then they consolidated or bought another company, which now is called Frontier, and the people in that got in control due to the consolidation didn't like Texas, and they told 800 and some of us out in Dallas that we didn't have a job anymore, that they were going to move our functions all to Rochester, New York. So that's when we moved back here.
Well, our daughter that ran the floors, her and her family moved into our house. Well, they kept our house going while we were there.
So this is where we lived, built us, and this is where we lived when we moved to Dallas. They moved in here, and then when we come back, like, they bought a house over in Leroux, and we moved back in here.
And what year did you guys get married?
In 63.
And this, and you built this house, or was here?
Yeah, he built this about 10 years later.
Tanya was born in 72. We signed the papers when I was in the hospital giving birth to Tanya.
I took the lawyer up so she could sign the papers to get the loan.
So you guys, for the first 10 years or so that you were married, did you live in Caledonia also, or in Marion?
We lived in a little house.
Across from the school, but not very long.
Across from the school for so many months, and then we bought a mobile home off of my uncle and had it down here on the farm. And I forget how long that was. And then when we outgrew it because of the kids, we moved into Marion on North Prospect Street. And then from North Prospect Street, we moved out on Old 309, the house, big farmhouse that's out there.
Belonged to Ralph Lyon.
And then we built this.
And how many kids did you guys have? You said 12?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that period of your life, raising kids. You were working, were you at GTE by then?
Oh, yeah.
And you were mostly at home?
Well, when we started the florist, I was just kids that weren't in school yet, and some of them got on the buses in Caledonia. Tommy and Amy were both small, and we took their Barbie dolls, and I did. Ran the business with the kids.
So when did the florist shop start, and why did it start? Maybe start with why. Where did this come from? I know you had worked in Camarillo's, and you were open to where God was leading you. So how did the business start?
We needed an extra income, and I didn't want a babysitter, and that was something, if I owned it, I could take my kids with me. Mm-hmm. And that's how we got it.
That's how we started.
I wasn't trained to be a florist, but it's like it can't be that hard. If God wills me, we'll figure it out.
And you said you started it in your basement.
Yeah.
What year? Was this like 73, 72?
About 74, I'd say, probably.
Yeah,
because Amy was born in 73, and I'd say
about 74. 75.
Yeah.
So what was it like starting a florist shop without any previous experience? You had some, but...
When I grew up on the farm, that's what we did. We learned how to do what we wanted to do just by experimenting and doing what we needed to do. And it was, everything I'd done was like that.
Were you growing flowers or getting them in and then cutting and arranging them? What did the business entail?
We still work with Clapper down in Columbus, which is a wholesaler, because I still have my vendor's license.
I knew of them working with Emily's. I just knew them as, you know, they were a supplier. And so we got some money. I think we had $50 that we got back from income tax. And we took it down, and that's how she got her first supplies to start the florist, was with that money. She drove down there and got set up with them.
And I still get calls. I've got two weddings. I've got two weddings, but I don't do live anymore. I did a few for the, when we were doing the farm market last year, I did a few, just picked them out of the garden and made an arrangement.
How did you build your customer base when you started the family business?
It was word of mouth. The only really advertising that we ever did was if somebody came in from the school and wanted support, some kind of support, and it would go into the, sports thing that they put out. That was the only, other than that, it was word of mouth.
And did you guys do weddings, funerals, Valentine's, the whole gamut of life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, oh my, Mother's Day and Valentine's Day, and you worked all night, you worked all day, you worked all night, you worked all day the next day, because you had all these deliveries that had to be made. And yeah, my dad helped with some of the deliveries, and he was working. My dad would come, and that gave Daddy something to do. Yeah.
Did you have types of flowers or arrangements that you kind of specialized in or that were your favorite to work with?
They just told me what they wanted, and I did it.
The big thing was,
I wasn't smart enough.
The big thing is that when she, we had good friends that would help at those busy times, you know. And the big thing that they used to say is when they'd take that, they'd answer the phone and they'd say, what are you doing? Old Phyllis knows.
That's the thing.
When you're
business
like that is then personal the way it was. Like,
his brother and his wife Candy, their daughter. She was working with me some, and she took a phone call one day and she said, "If Phyllis hits the Pentagon, what do I do?" And I said, "It's the call." It was Brad Kyle that was married to Carolyn Phillips that lived behind the building there. He was part of the Pentagon, and he needed flowers to go to Phillips. So just take the call, whatever.
Wow. So you were at working out of your house for how many years, did you say?
Wasn't that long, I think. A couple years, maybe.
Here?
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years, yeah, we worked out of here.
And where did you guys go next?
In the Caledonia, to that building.
That building.
It was bigger than what we could house the kids and the business. It had grown fast. Yeah.
How did you pick that location in the Masonic Loft building? Was it just that was the one that was available in downtown?
It was available, and it was close to home. It wasn't that far away, and that's what.
And we could see, you know, where she could go in there, and she could have to take the kids in, and it was convenient.
And at the time, it's got some vinyl up now. I think it blew in from the storm. But did it have the original old storefront back then?
Yeah, it was the old glass.
Right. And it wasn't a double one. It was almost like one side and then the door. You didn't have both sides glass, right?
No, the door's setting right like it was.
On the right side.
Set back in. And then it come out and there was glass pane there. And then there was a big glass pane, the whole front. And that was a nice, and we used it as a display window up there.
And what did you guys say right before you moved in? Was that the post 401 Legion in that space, or was it empty when you got there?
It was empty when we moved in.
It was empty when we moved in. It had been set there for quite a little while, and when we moved in, and it didn't have any heat, and a friend of mine happened to have a furnace sitting in his garage, and I bought that off of him and put it in there, and matter of fact, it's probably still sitting in there, then store fixtures and stuff, we just picked those up different places where we'd find somebody had them, was doing, getting rid of something or something, and for, you know, might pick them up for 15, 20 bucks or something like that. That's how we got our card racks. I have some of those card racks that we, and they're probably still in there.
I think they are. I think I've seen them.
We went down to Mount Vernon, a Hallmark store or something. Mm-hmm. We found out it was going out of business, and we went down there and tore them down and hauled them back.
But if you've been in that building, you probably noticed the ceiling that has flowers painted on it. Those are hand painted by me.
We took them. Took those out and you painted them and put them back in.
So there was already the drop ceiling, but you decorated
it. It was the drop ceiling, but yeah, he took the tiles out for me and I just hand painted them.
I always wondered, I didn't know the history. That's amazing. At the time, was there anything like what you were doing in Caledonia? Was there any flower shop or card shop, or were you guys the first?
We were the first, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
How did business change once you had that location on the square?
Well, we kept the customers we had, and it just kept growing from there. It was, yeah, and people came in, and sometimes people come in just to unload. They just wanted somebody to talk to that knew they wouldn't go any farther. What they said wouldn't go any farther. So sometimes it was just therapy.
Free therapy.
Yeah.
One of the cute things that we remember is when our girls were small and they were playing out front in that little corner there. Your great grandfather.
Warren.
We would see him. He was standing there watching them, smiling, watching them play out there. and he used to watch them.
We had to go over and get Dippy Dot bologna. It was the pickle and pimento loaf. They called it Dippy Dot. We had to go get Dippy Dot bologna.
And your grandfather knew what Dippy Dot was.
That's your job. Knew what Dippy Dot was.
So that was not a regional term. That was a your kids only term.
That was our kids, because we had Dippy Dots in that.
I grew up on pickle pimento loaf. My Jeff is from Maryland. He has no idea what I'm talking about. I don't think they eat that outside of Ohio. Is that why you guys set up for the farmer's market where you do, because of all the memories on that corner? Or you like the shade?
Yeah, we originally, I said, I don't think I want to do for 3 hours, but then getting used to all the people again, and they'd come through there and we'd visit, and that was the good part. That, I wanted to go back in there with Barbone, and after that, and she said, old fellas, it's not in good shape, because I wanted to take my crash back into that building. And she said it wasn't up to being able to use like that. Because I make my own greeting cards now.
We'll see what we can do to get fixed up and get you back in. But yeah, they've been, I think those storefronts have been, they've been unoccupied since. Did Linda Smith have it after you guys, or?
I'm not sure. There was.
Oh, she in the middle.
There was a balloon place.
Okay.
In there. Wasn't there some kind of a
tanning beds,
that's what I want. Yeah.
But I think the last shop probably went out in the 90s, mid-90s.
I don't think they would have had tanning beds in the module we were in.
It might have been in the middle.
Yeah, it was in there. I remember the from the front.
Unless they went and done some work on the electric, they wouldn't have had the power to run candidates, I don't think. Maybe they did.
So I want to ask, or we talked a little bit before I turned the recorder on, but tell me again what you guys were saying about tracking down the lease and the arrangement with the Masons. Because I think that's one of the most unique things about those two buildings in the Union Block, that they had fraternal organizations upstairs and businesses downstairs. So can you guys tell me that story?
The only thing I knew about it was, you know, when we bought the building, they had to research it after they found the deed. They had to research it, and when we bought it, they give us that deed and stuff, you know, and it was all just part of basically, as we said, yeah, I understand before that building was there, there was a white building, a wood structure there.
Yeah, it was called the Temple Block, I think.
Okay, and across the street, catty corner across there, I wonder if it was similar to what I remember over there growing up as a kid. There was a strip over there that was a white structure from the corner. We'll call it the old post office, the city building now, over to Carol Ulf's building. There was a section in there, and I think somebody told me one time there was a shoe repair in there. There was somebody lived in part of one of the modules when I was a kid. I know that. But I think that's what was there. Now, whether that was tore down or burnt, I never knew the story about that. But then the building that was built there, and that's when the lease was set out with the Masons to have that whole upper part of it. 99-year lease for a dollar.
And I can send you out, when I nominated those buildings for the National Register, I dug up, I have newspaper article pictures of sketches from when the buildings were being built. The original building was three stories wood. It was called the Temple Block Building, and all of the fraternal organizations were upstairs. The Masons, the Pythians, the Oddfellows, and it burned, and then the people on the bottom level, like Pittman and Irwin, if you walked to the back of Reese's Market, that space, that was Pittman and Irwin. The people who had the stores financed the upstairs. So the first fire happened in 1896, and then they built the brick buildings in 1897.
Okay. Now, I understand, somebody told me that window that looks out in the sidewalk from the grocery store out, that used to be a business there, a barber shop or something.
I've heard that too. There's a door that's been covered up, right?
Yeah. And I had heard that, but I never knew any facts about it. I just heard that.
That's why I'm excited we're doing this, because from all the interviews, we can piece together some of the puzzle of it. But
it wasn't, I may be wrong, but wasn't there like a restaurant or something in where the grocery store was originally?
There were two storefronts. And this is probably, maybe when, no, you weren't in high school yet. My great-grandpa Warren bought it in, he bought it in 55, 53, it opened in 55, but it was two stores. The one on the right, Pittman and Irwin, had been a dry goods store, and one of them then became Melvin Thomas' store, which was Jim Waddell's grandpa, and the one on the left was originally a restaurant for a while, but then I think it became a grocery store, too. When Warren bought it, he tore out the wall in between and made it very modern. That's why it kind of looks very 50s, because it's from the 50s. Did you remember before Reese's Market, from when you were a kid?
I just remember that it was something else. The what I remember most out of the whole square was the Garber Girls across the street there where the library was. And on Saturday night, they had the screen up on the side of the building. They just block that part of the square off and show movies. And we used to go right inside the door there, and Garber's had their ice cream right in there. And they had one of these cooler freezers that had the lids that come up like this, the old style. And they had the buckets of ice cream down there, and they would dip it out of there and make the ice cream cone. And I remember that.
So they hosted the movies on the square.
I don't know who hosted them, or whether it was a town thing or what.
But this was when you were a kid in the 50s.
Yeah. See, and I only remember being up in the town hall once in my life, up those stairs and up there.
What did they have up there at the time?
Well, they used to have dances up there on the weekends and stuff, but, and stuff, and the jail was down on the lower level, and the fire department was right there in the back. That was the fire department before they built the new one.
And the post office for a while, right?
And the post office was there. That was all right there in that area.
Kind of like all the municipal services in one castle.
Right.
Sounded like there was just so much happening right in Caledonia. It's kind of amazing to think about.
It was. Back in the days when your great-grandfather and Mr. Stickle was, you had Bob had the mechanics thing, and you had the Shell station was going, and there used to be a little Standard Oil station on the corner where the apartments are. It's up there right on the corner. And 309, or 30 then, went right through town and made the curve. And my brother's car was damaged in the square. He used to go in and park his car there on the northwest side of the square. They would park there, and another person, there was three of them that rode together. They worked at Eaton, and two of them would park their car there, and off in the third one would go to work. Well, my brother, they were making the highway, the bypass that we know it is now out there where the Ohio station and that is. Two trucks come together in the square and like this and slid over, and it hit the two cars that were sitting there that belonged to my brother and another guy. And that was one of the things that happened there. But I remember when the Ohio station was built, Doc Axelm owned it.
The doctor owned the gas station.
He owned the gas station, and I thought of the guy's name the other day that run it for as many years as I remembered.
That's not the Les Cozzi you mentioned.
Huh?
That's not Mr. Cozzi? Cozzi? Les Cozzi?
No.
I thought that was, maybe I'm saying it wrong. I thought you said that name. Cozzi?
Kazoo,
sorry.
He ran the one uptown.
Oh.
And then built the new station that's out there on the corner.
But that wasn't the Sohio
station. The farmer's co-op station now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
This is when you guys were teenagers or in high school, maybe right after, I forget the exact year. How did the Hollow Bypass change life in the town? Did you guys see an effect from that over the years?
I remember when it was built.
I was a freshman when that highway went through.
And also that stretch that goes down to Five Points when that went through there, because it used to jog over, run along the railroad track, and come back to there. I remember when that was built through there, too. That was all about the same time.
Were people upset at the time, or were they couldn't do anything about it, the government?
Well, it was like
the commander daddy, and he had no choice. You have to let him go through, because that's when I learned what the right of eminent domain was. You had nothing to say about it. They told you what they were doing, and you didn't have any choice.
I found an article from when the highway was going through, and they interviewed, I think they interviewed Warren and a lot of the business owners, and it was kind of heartbreaking to read it. It was from that when they were building it. Everyone was so optimistic, and they were like, it's not going to impact business at all. Everyone's going to still come downtown, but I think over time that wasn't true.
Right, it wasn't. But, yeah, it hurt business.
You know, I think the Farmers Co-op being up there last, the people were so happy to see something going on in Caledonia. That was the...
Oh, for the market last summer?
Yeah, that's the feedback they got. They were tickled that something was going on there in Caledonia.
See, when we were, had the forest business, they used to have, what do they call it, Caledonia Farm Days?
Yeah.
The Farmers Festival.
Right.
And we used to, they used to set a stage up. One time it was over, I still call it the library over there. One time it was set up in the corner by us. And, I mean, that, people just looked forward to that. They had their pie baking contests and their this and that. And everything, and they had the tent set up there, and they had all kinds of stuff going on. And I used to take the PA equipment in and set it up. I had the equipment to do that.
He just heard he's got sound system.
For the farmer's market?
We've got that in the back room.
Good to know. You know, we just wrote a grant for the farmers.
I heard you talk about sound systems. So we went the other
way. I just thought the like it. I could fill that whole area with
DJ Ted Model.
No problem.
So the Farmers Festival, it sounds like there were, from the movies on the square to Farmers Festival probably in the 70s when you had your shop, there were things that happened on a seasonal calendar that people could look forward to.
Well, you also had, it worked along with, the Farmers Festival worked along with the fire department, what do you want to call it, volunteers in the fire department? Okay. That all worked together. I mean, they worked hard on that, the volunteers of the fire department. And they had the dunking machine. They used to set up and have water battles with fire hoses. They had a big barrel up and in the middle of a line between two things, like a clothesline. And two teams would get up and try to shove that barrel with a stream of water back against it. It was like a tug of war, only the opposite was the way. Type thing and stuff, and people loved that. I mean, that was great, and they supported it. And then you had, I can't think of their names, but you had one of the big supporters of it was the family of that has Logan Tire in Marion. I can't think of their name, but they lived in Caledonia. And they were quite supporters, especially when it come to the auction. They had an auction every way, and he used to have fun bidding against Kenny Comstock and stuff like that. I mean, they had run some things up to some ridiculous prices, you know, between them. It was just all for fun and advertisement, but...
Then I hadn't heard you talk about Freeman's had that.
Oh, yeah.
Had the
TV.
Well, it was the TV, but then it turned into the
ceramic shop.
Ceramic shop there when Carol Oates building.
Before that, that was Clark. Mr. Clark had the RCA
appliance. And then Freeman had the ceramic.
Yeah.
Well, he
years later Freeman moved in.
TV.
Yeah, he.
Freeman.
Freeman's had Zenith.
Yeah.
And they were Zenith. This seller.
And then Ruby took over and had the ceramic shop there for quite a few years.
Tell me her last name again.
Freeman.
Oh, she was Ruby Freeman. So same family.
Yeah. It was, they were husband and wife. But they're both gone now. And I'm not sure where all the kids are. I know the one girl, it's not Barbie. Barbie moved to California, but the gal that married, the one that was,
They had the chicken farm, Bales.
Yeah.
Married to Bales.
He married the Bales boy. And that's the only one I know of where they might be at.
What about the fraternal organizations downtown, like the Masons, the Pythians, the Odd Fellows, the Sisters of Rebecca, Lady Pythian's Eastern Star. Were you guys involved in any of the fraternal stuff?
No.
Did you encounter any events they did or work with any of the organizations at all?
The only thing I ever done was for the women's Eastern Stars.
Were they meeting above Reese's Market back then, or were they already across the street?
That wasn't where I met up with them, because they wanted me to come in and show them how to arrange flowers, and that was the only thing that I had.
And I think that was after they moved above the pizza shop and stuff over on that side.
I wasn't upstairs, so I'm trying to think where in the world we were at. Whether we were in somebody's house or something, because they had some funny rules about who was allowed to go up into that. You had to be.
It's kind of secret. They're secret societies, right? I mean, one of the things that I think is so interesting for this project is, for a town of our size, we had so many of these secret societies, like the whole downtown. So, did you guys interact with the Masons at all, like with them being upstairs, or you said you couldn't go in, right?
No, they wouldn't let me up there.
So you owned the building, but you couldn't even go check on it to see if it was okay.
They wouldn't allow me up there.
And you said the roof started leaking.
I wanted to go in and look at something that went along with the sewer system, okay, because it went up the corner in our building to get upstairs so they could have potties. And there was something that I wanted to see up there, and they wouldn't let me go up. I told them, I said, I'll go up the fire escape and I'll go in that way. No, you won't.
Top secret.
So it was something else. So.
Seemed like it was kind of maybe a small group of people who were part of those organizations, but not everyone was.
Right. It's only if you chose to be. Yeah. And then you had to put up with the
rituals. So tell me about the evolution of the family floor. Once you moved into the Masonic Block building, into your module, that storefront right plus the Reese's Market, we think maybe 70. When did you move in there?
74. About 74.
What? How long did you stay there, and how did the business change over the years? Was it always just best flowers, or did it go in different directions?
Pretty much we stayed with some French flowers. We sold plants, because I would go to Mansfield to
Schoolgirls.
Huh?
Schoolgirls at Mansfield. And the other places.
It's on the way to Ontario. It's still going.
Wonder Garden.
And you sell cactuses, stuff like that?
I would sell garden plants. We'd set them out front on the sidewalk, and people would pick out what they wanted, run them, and paper on them. But I had my cards in there. They were bottom cards because I had vendor's license. We would go to the gift mart and buy things and bring it in. And we had some of my crad, not much. I didn't get much into crafts until after I got out of there.
You got into some craft stuff, supplies, before you got out of there.
Right, we had some.
But then you closed it during when we were having, and you closed it and stuff, and then reopened it. Heidi reopened it,
mm-hmm.
And then we took a. She took it back over when Heidi wanted to get out of there.
That was before we went to Dallas.
Because
when Tanya was in there was when we finally said, you know, we've had enough.
Because it was, I think when I was, before I met you guys, you know, I found you in the newspapers trying to track the history of the building, and I thought at one point it, like, became more of a craft store and not a flower shop, but was that not under you guys, or a card shop? Or was that all, we always had flowers, basically?
We always had flowers. Yeah, we went from pretty much to all silk at last, and got out of the...
Tommy was still carrying like Easter flowers and stuff, mm-hmm. of course. But when what was his name? I had the funeral home before Mark.
Bob Allen.
Oh, if he had a funeral, I was overwhelmed with flowers.
The biggest one that she had was when Gwen Comstock died.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, she was getting calls from, direct calls from all over. And
was she a big figure in the community?
Well, we had the, I think we went to Columbus twice to get flowers because it was other days than when they delivered. And we had to go get flowers to complete the orders.
What was his name? The funeral director?
Bob.
His wife would say, I'm not even in here when you bring them in, but I know everyone that's yours. I hadn't been trained to see. This is exactly what you do.
Or you're an artist and you have your own style and they recognize your signature.
They recognize what I do.
Yeah, you know, I could deliver, you know, and then sometimes we'd end up going to a funeral and I could always tell which was her design because it was her design, her thing. And I was used to that kind of stuff because of delivering stuff for Hemorrhage, and I knew all the funeral homes and the people to deliver them to, and stuff, and the hospital. And
then we got, so we worked with, like, Cardington and Mount Gilead and Marion and Bucyrus, and we would call each other instead of, if we were overwhelmed, we would call them and say, can you do this for me? And they would call me and say, can you do this for us? And so we worked together that way.
Like all the florists and the three of them.
Right. Yeah.
It was just a thing that happened, you know, over a period of time. They would call and say, Tulsa, would you take an order for us to take the funeral home or something like that? Or if there was a funeral up at Bucyrus and we only had like one or two, she'd call up there and ask them if they could do it. And that way, and it was kind of a gentleman's agreement, but it helped out when, you know, traveling distance and stuff.
And you guys were working simultaneous to when Charla was still running Hemorrhage.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He was a legend.
Yeah. I showed up one day with wedding flowers, and she had them too. And I said, did you get paid for that? She was so mad, because I had been paid for to do the job.
You showed up where? To a wedding?
To a church, or to a new wedding.
Wedding, yeah.
So she thought she got the order too?
And she thought she had, but she had never been paid. And I had been.
Oh, no.
Said, oh, I'm sorry, I've been paid to do this wedding.
She told her, she told her, I told her one time, she said, yeah, because of you, you're in competition. Phyllis, you're the only competition I've got.
Oh, she was not happy then.
Well, I guess that, you know, those things happen in the business, but it's kind of cool that there was this network, and some of the time you guys were collaborative, but you, so opening year in 74, when did you guys go to Texas and walk away? What year was that? Was this in the 80s or into the 90s?
No, it was 90...
I retired in 93.
Well, I was going to say, we went to the Holy Land in 98, and we had been there because I had a care group in the church down there, and they wanted somebody to lead a care group. And with a lot, in fact, we got one of them on the, we just got a picture of one of the Filipinos. We had a lot of Filipinos, and they were ready to go to the Holy Land. And I said, now I know why I'm here, because I had wanted to go to the Holy Land forever. And
like Israel, Palestine, all over
that. Right, yeah. And so we just had a private group. There was 13 of us. And we had a tour guide, private tour guide, and we went, that was in 98, so it was before 98.
Yeah. So, well, 93 is when I retired from GTE.
But I'm thinking, we were down there 8 years,
mm-hmm.
and your surgery was in 2002, so if you go back, I think 2000, it was when the turnover of the time from the 1999 to the 2000 was when we came back.
Mm-hmm.
So you were probably in Texas for a lot of the 90s when you came back
right.
in 2000.
Yeah.
And when you were gone, your daughter Tanya was running it, the shop?
Well, just a couple years she did, yeah.
And then she sold it?
We sold it, to oh. Jack, yeah.
That's when we sold the building.
Yeah, he found out we were closing the building down, and he wanted to buy the building, and so we just sold it to Jack.
You know why he wanted to buy it? I'm just curious.
I think because he owned all that. He owned all that.
Because we owned the middle one from Warren.
And I was the only one building there that he didn't own yet.
No, he didn't own the...
Merge.
He didn't own Merge until after ours.
Not possible.
No.
I'm always curious why he... Why he wanted to acquire all those and what the plan was. I wish I could ask him.
No clue, but I know they did a lot of storage in there, but then they did rent it out to them. I know that because there was other businesses in there. Yeah.
I know that before Merv moved out, he had closed the business quite a bit, and he had that building stock pull it up, and they had a lot of stuff to move out of there.
From Merv.
I mean, I don't think, I think Merv moved it out before it was sold. And I don't think Merv sold it originally to your grandfather.
Sold it to someone else. He sold it to my grandfather.
I think it was sold to Johnny McKinstry.
Yep,
and then
that's
Johnny
right.
sold it to your grandfather.
I remember that now. That was a... Because Mer wouldn't sell it to Jack.
Uh-oh. I think I've heard this.
It kind of went around me.
Yeah.
Traveling around the world a little bit.
Yeah.
What was it like for you guys to decide to let that shop go? I mean, you've been there, what, almost, like you said, almost 20 years. If not, more than that, maybe.
Well, like I said, we still get calls. To deliver to or make a gray saddle, or we just filled here what a couple weeks ago today, filled some more cemetery vases. It's, you know, it's still
you, used to make grave blankets, and we put them out there in front of the window in that corner, and people would pick them up, or it was for winter, or we would deliver them and put them on, which I was used to doing that because I used to do it for Emily. And
no, we still were doing rain blankets until not this year, but the year before.
Year before.
It started getting hard getting pine because of all the fires.
And
we were having trouble. Last year we couldn't get any pine. It was so tight to get.
We tried many suppliers.
But we were doing quite a few rain blankets, yeah.
So you sold the building, but you didn't stop the business. You just did it back out of your home?
Whatever got set, that's what I did.
If they called, we weren't advertising. It was another one of those things. Hey, Phyllis, can you do this? Type thing.
I kind of backed off of weddings. You know, if there's somebody close to us, I may do one, but they are a real... They are a real challenge, weddings are.
You said you thought you did someone in my family's wedding, maybe?
I did your mom's, I think. Was your mom,
My mom was Debbie.
Yeah.
But I don't think she had a wedding. I thought they eloped. I'll have to ask.
I thought whoever it was got married in the church at the Church of Christ in...
Kirkpatrick?
Kirkpatrick.
Might have been my Aunt Carrie.
I was going to say, it could be Carrie. But we did one of the weddings for them, yeah.
In a wedding, we're talking, like, how many flowers? Are we talking about 500 flowers in a wedding? Easy?
No.
You're talking about single flowers?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Thousands.
By the time you get, it depends on how many bouquets you got to make, how many table centerpieces you got to make.
But it's like weeks of work.
Oh, yeah. That's why I got flowers. These two are both mauve. I have never had mauve flowers. We even went to the wholesaler, and they did not have mauve flowers. So I've got.
Do you have to dye them?
I've got a real. Well, I've got the spray. I bought some of the spray. It's mauve, and so we'll probably be. I got to get started on that.
You have to paint the flowers to get them that color.
I'll hold them way out and just tin them because they're silk. These are silk. I'm not doing live flowers.
Why did you guys switch to silk? I had never heard of that before I was reading about your shop in the newspaper. And I guess maybe I haven't been to that many weddings. Maybe I haven't paid attention. But where did the silk flower thing come from?
When the silk flowers first started coming in, I actually made them. You bought kits and made the flowers.
Were they like lilies or roses or anything?
Anything you wanted to do, and you had to order the kits. And make your silk flowers. And then they got really big, and that was a blessing, because making all of them was something else. But there are silk flowers out now that you can't hardly tell. But if you're looking at them from a distance, you don't know but what they're real. They are so, they've come a long way.
We've seen people walk up to feel them to make sure that
they've come a long way.
Whether they're real or not.
It's a benefit that people can keep them. And then they have the flowers.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Price wise, are they more or less expensive than real flowers?
It depends on where you buy them at. You can buy them at the Dollar Tree now, and it's like, whoa, you got a whole bouquet of flowers, or Walmart, or Hobby Lobby, or wholesalers.
Used to be the only place you could get them is the florist wholesaler.
Right.
Or special places like that. And you bought them in a box, and there were so many in a box, and I remember getting shipments where you would order them from this company, and they'd come in boxes, but now I can go pick out a lot of places, and the quality.
And if you watch for the sales, I mean, you can get some decent prices.
So we're talking like, are those purple ones on the stand over there, are those silk or those real?
Those are silk.
Really?
Those are violets, yeah. Yeah, I'm not.
But I think, okay, so I've probably seen them. Like any kind of fake flower is pretty much a silk flower.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. Absolutely like that.
Those are from the Dollar Tree.
Wow.
They pay $1.25 for that.
They do look realistic. The leaves could use a little work, but the flowers are good.
I work till I feel I've got the color that I want.
Oh.
Those come from the wholesaler. And
wow.
I'm going to use these to mix them with wildflowers because they're kind of, I think that's it right in. Come on.
And some of the supplies that she wanted to use, the holders, couldn't, the wholesalers don't use those anymore. They've come up with a holder for the flower industry is different, and I had to go online and found them and ordered the holders for out of New Jersey.
And they sit down in a doily. Yeah.
It's cool that the technology of floral arranging has shifted, you know, it keeps evolving in different ways.
It does.
Makes it hard to keep up, though. You have to get the right price.
Right.
Well, what other parts of your experience in Caledonia have we not talked about yet? Are there parts of your story that you guys want to share that I haven't got to ask about? Talk about how you got into crafting.
How I got into crafting?
Well, I walked in through the craft room, so it's clearly a part of your life, and I'm curious where that started. Because now you sell all over the place at craft markets, right?
Right, but I think I was born with the want to create, and if even the flowers were creating, you were creating something. And when you're dressing dolls or that, Kim's wife and Vicki that have the produce, she gave me boxes of yarn and I'm going, oh, I know what I'm going to do with that. That's a Navajo Indian blanket. And whenever you run out of one color, you just throw in another color. But that's what I like to do is to create. And I think that everything I've done, even the music, is some kind of creation.
Tell me about some of the things you produce and make and sell as crafts. Like you do blankets, you do dolls and clothing. What else?
Mm-hmm. Well, you can see some of it out there in the
room.
But I make rag rugs. That's what all that pile there. I cut rags, and what's behind you is the rags I cut so that I because it takes 6 balls to make one rug, and that I figure I got about 20 hours. In a rug. But I was doing some of that even when I was doing the flowers. And I had some, a little bit of craft stuff in there, but we were going to the gift mart and buying a lot of that.
And that was kind of the era, right? Like, I'm thinking back on my mom and my aunt. They were very into, you know, cut out wood with a certain kind of saw and paint.
Right.
It was like the country chic. It was like a whole thing in the 80s, right? That people did kind of country style homemade stuff.
Right.
Bears, dolls, rugs. And was that when you saw the market really pick up for a lot of that stuff?
Yeah, I suppose. But one of the things that got me into the crafting, when you're raising 5 kids and you got to pay the bills and make sure they're fed and they can get to school. You learn how to sew all their clothes. You learn how to make their Christmas presents. It's just part of life. They don't do that anymore, and it's sad. It's really kind of sad.
Our grandkids, they relish getting they even have some things that they say, well, I still got what Grandma made me, and we don't use it. I've got it tucked away someplace.
Pillowcases. They made them all pillowcases with their names on them one year. And they still got them. But,
we made little.
Our family outgrew buying Christmas presents for all them grandkids and great grandkids. So for I don't know how many years, on New Year's Day, when nobody else had anywhere else to go, we did bingo. And all year I would make things, I would buy stuff on sale, And so when we did our bingo, they picked out the Christmas gifts that they wanted. Some of them they fought over because
we just threw the box.
But it was just, it was fun to do, and it was creating. And
they used to call it the room out there and set up, because we didn't have the stuff in there. We had a big banquet table in the middle of it, and chairs all around it. They'd go out there and play bingo for hours.
And with five kids, how many grandkids and great-grandkids do you guys have? Is it like?
We have 17, but then Tim's baby, he only had one child, and his baby's in the cemetery, was born not living. And now, of course, he's got Vicky's kids and grandkids. But we had 17, and then those 17 grandkids have got us to 35 great-grandkids.
Those people can all fit in this house?
We don't have them here anymore. Heidi had them out there at that place on 309 that sits back in. She has something at Thanksgiving.
So you're going to have to rent a hall.
Oh, my. We can't get them all in here anymore. But we've got swings and stuff. How I like if summertime, sometime they can all come off, but there just isn't even room to do that anymore. But that place out there on 309, they've got swings and stuff. That's a great place to take kids, and it's big, so that when you had the COVID going on, you could spread out.
I've always seen it off the road, but I've never known.
It's really
what
a nice
it is.
Place.
Went back to the police place. Yeah.
Oh, is it like a police fraternal organization?
It's not a fraternal organization. It's
what's it called? It's got a name like Steve Young Memorial.
Yeah, it is, but it's right. He was a Marion City policeman, and but it's a nice building back there with big covered deck, porch type thing, looking out over a small lake.
Yeah, a little pond there.
A pond, whatever you want to call it.
And
then on the other side of it, you've got the driveway, and across the driveway, you've got all kinds of playground equipment. And it's quite a nice place. You got a little kitchenette in there, and you got restrooms inside, and you've got big screen TVs mounted up on the wall.
Yeah,
so
that's
when where you're out there and it happens to be
somebody has
a holiday with a ball game, football game or something, they're watching it.
We do have so many community, like at the Anselm at Park building we were at, we have so many gathering spaces in Caledonia, which is neat. I have a few more questions for you guys. Do you want to take a break, bathroom, water? Cool. I'm going to ask you guys a question I think you're going to like, which is, I got to know you guys really well through the farmer's market this summer, and I would love to hear what you think about the farmer's market and what it was like being back on the square from, 20 years after your shop closed? More than that, 25, 30.
Like I said, the people were there with open arms, and you could communicate with them again like you did before, and it just was kind of nice to be back. And of course Tim and Vicky with her baked goods, and I told her she needed to get her a little van that she went through on Saturday morning with baked goods.
We're going to get some sauce over those pumpkin rolls.
Oh, my. But, I think that was it. Just being able to communicate, seeing something happening in Caledonia.
I think it kind of helped bring the community back to a community feeling, or whatever you want to call it, closeness, instead of, okay, we'll go buy your house. That type of thing. And we know you live down there, but we never talk to you unless we run into you at the post office. But other than that, I think it let people get it. You'd see people, hi, I haven't seen you in a long time. They'd be over in the corner someplace talking. They may be talking to one another for quite a while. And it was bringing back doing acquaintances and stuff like that, you know. And I know we, being out here, we go through, you know, we know the people there. I don't see my brother that much. And I got to more where I pick up and call him every once in a while. My brother and my sister. So my sister lives at the Osiris. But we don't get to see him that often.
And God was good with the weather. We had excellent Saturdays. Could have rained all week, and Saturday was that was great.
You guys are coming back this year?
We were planning on it. We're signed up, yeah.
Every week?
We do the Desiris Farm Days, and then we do Richwood Farm Days. And one's in June, one's in July. And so I'm marked down there all but those two. And those are three-day events. And we grew up on the farm. We're in the farm. And I take a lot of farm stuff with me.
And is that your main livelihood now? Not just the Caledonia Farmers Market, but do you guys travel around to lots of craft shows and fairs, or mostly those you just live
in? Anymore since COVID. There used to be some church events, but they aren't doing them since COVID. And we don't like to get in a closed-in building too much. Because with his pulmonary valve, we don't take the shots because anything foreign he puts in his body affects that valve. And that's what we've been told. And so we just take precautions about where we're going to be at. The farm markets, the farm, they are open buildings, and usually we're right by the door where the fresh air is all coming in, and we stay our distance. And
we get pretty much our thicker where we want to be in it, because of, the years we've attended them and stuff and help promote their business. So we get a pretty good, generally get a pretty good location, and not crammed up against, you know, somebody else. Like you get in a small church, one that they're having a thing. Even the school, you get it to school, and you're in so tight, they put you in so tight, and it's not that way at the farm day.
Yeah, I'm surprised a lot of events. I feel like we learned a lot from COVID, or are learning a lot, and I'm surprised some events and places have gone back to, like, it's not still here, and it is, especially if you're vulnerable or can't be vaccinated. But I wish more events were able to do, like, what the farmers market is doing, where it's outside, spread apart, because I think that's more comfortable for people in general, if it's nice out.
Well, it's even healthier.
Yeah.
But they're saying now this raising again, a lot of COVID.
2 weeks ago in Columbus, it was up 43%. So, like I said, I wear my mask everywhere because I go in and out of Garfield Elementary in an art classroom where we see every class of kids. So it's 120 kids a day.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, and it's just the community we live in. Every, you know, parents work, they're making a lot of money, so kids are getting sent to school with COVID.
Right.
And they're not always going to get a test or check because that means they have to find child care. And that costs money, so I try to be extra careful because I know that's the reality in our community. But what my last question I want to ask you guys, and you can tell me if you have anything else, what, for you guys, what would you like to see as the future of the public square of downtown Caledonia? What do you think is possible in 5 years or 10 years?
It would be great to see some businesses opening back up, and you don't even have a bank anymore. And that hurts. The people, you know, would talk about, we can't even go to the bank. At least they got the post office there. But we were talking to Norma Fryer. It sounded like maybe Doug was going to be selling used to be the dugout. Yeah, somebody was interested.
Oh, the kennel.
Yeah, the place on the corner.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not dugout pizza, though. Other thing.
No, not dugout. It's Doug Fryer. And he had the restaurant down on the corner. And his health just isn't, he's had some heart problems and stents and stuff. And but he said he's got somebody interested because I had said something to him. Well, if you want me to, because he used to be our son-in-law. That was Heidi's first husband. And their kids are her grandkids. But it would just be good to see activity going on again. I mean, you got the Dollar General there, but it's not the same.
It's not local.
It's not, when you go in there and you don't feel like old friends, or I've just got somebody to talk. I need to talk to somebody over at the counter. And that was a big thing for the people to come in and just needed to talk. And they knew I would keep it under my hat and I wouldn't spread it. They needed help. But I think that's the thing, that people would just like to...
That's where you lost your community. That was part of the community effect of having businesses there. And I think, you know, you go through Ainsley. I went through there yesterday. You know, we went through there yesterday. I used to travel through there all the time. And there's more stuff opened up in Ainsley than was there when I was traveling through there all the time. And, I mean, they're not anything big businesses and not anything to write home about too much, but it's a community. Back in the community.
Yeah, I had said something to Doug, you know, if you think about it, you don't mind, I'll bring my stuff in there because you got a counter, you got tables, you know, we could, and I don't think he was comfortable with that because something about it needed some repairs too, and maybe whoever buys it will probably do the repairs, I'm sure. But.
Do you guys think if shops came back, do you think people would support that economically like they used to with all the Dollar Generals and the box stores now? I know that's what, when I talk about my dream for my grandma's buildings, that's the thing everyone always tells me, well, we've got Dollar General now, we've got Walmart now. We didn't in the 80s and 90s. Well, I guess by 2000 we had Walmart. But do you think people would still shop local like that?
The things that I create, when I went to Mount Gilead, when Carol Alt told me there was asbestos in that building, and so they didn't dare let anybody in, they were trying to get some kind of, that was when he was still living, they were trying to get some kind of a grant to maybe get that asbestos out of there.
For the Class of 55 building?
Yeah. And she couldn't, and then your grandma couldn't, and so I ended up going to a building over there in Mount Gilead. And even all the other stores that are in Mount Gilead, you would not believe how busy I was because I got stuff you can't buy at Walmart. Mine is created, and it's not stuff that you can get at Walmart. I even sold fabric over there. And it's just, if you're just carrying the same thing and you got to put a higher price on it because you bought it, that's one thing. But if it's because you put yourself into it and you made it for a lower price, and it's something that they don't really have. And the other thing they'll do is, okay, can you make me that and this? You can't go into Walmart and do that. You buy what they got.
Do you think if people are looking at those niche markets and the homemade quality stuff, that's where we'll bring the economy back, selling that sort of stuff, not trying to sell toilet paper like Dollar General?
But why do you think they go to the Amish territory?
Because of handmade stuff.
Because they're looking for, we know better, but they're looking for handmade stuff. We met the Amish down at the
Gift
Mart. And the women were pulling anything off In November, there was one day when you could go in and you could buy off the shelves. You did not have to order a dozen. And the women were pulling it off the shelves and the guys were carrying it out. And it
anything that looked handmade, like doilies and
quilts
and stuff like that.
And then we'd get it back and have doilies.
And you,
they're smart business people. I mean, what can you say? They know what sells.
Yeah, what's the other thing? They take it back, take the made in Japan or made in Korea or wherever out of it, stick their little hand made sticker thing in it, and you'll find it up at what's the name of that place over
Charlotte?
Well, not Charlotte, you won't over at that restaurant over on the other side of Mansfield.
The Dutchman?
Huh? The Dear Dutchman? That's where I've noticed. I mean, I can walk in there and show you what comes from down there.
But see, that's why they're going to the Amish, because it is handmade. Whether they did it or not, it is. And it's something different. And that's what they liked about what I was doing.
What's so crazy to me, you know, is that's what we had in Caledonia 20, 30 years ago. It's like if Reese's Market could have held on, if your shop was still there. Now that the shopping local, the buying local, the history is in, and it wasn't quite in the same way in the 90s, I think all of that, my grandpa's handmade sandwiches, the Amish cheese, curly milk, your shop, I think we would have had tourists coming from Columbus. I think people would have flocked here because we had those local businesses that had the character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we'll see if it can happen again. Is there anything in your lives or work, through the flower shops, your connection to Caledonia that you didn't get to talk about that you want to share for this interview?
I mean, you know, it used to be centered. Caledonia, I grew up, you had Landmark, and you had the other elevator there. You had the creamery, we used to call it, which the building's not, I tore down now, but they're over on, across from the water tower. And I remember going to all those places. We used to take stuff in there. You had other businesses. You had the bank. I mean, it was kind of that's where you did business. And then we got mobile. Okay. You got mobile. People got travel. Cars, money, gasoline, you name it. People got moving around. And that's what was the downfall of these little towns, you know. For some reason, people decided, we'll buy it someplace else. It's just like, why isn't the stores in the mall in Marion anymore? People go to Columbus. You know, they don't support the stuff in Marion.
Well, we see them at Walmart and Myers and
now.
Yeah, and they carry clothing and they carry shoes and they carry what was in the mall. So I think part of it was just the competition of what they were able to get somewhere else.
Well, any last thoughts on the downtown? You guys have shared so much and I've learned a ton.
It's going to take a lot of investment and stuff. Whoever gets it going, we're past the age of being able to get involved heavily in getting into a new business or whatever. But whoever does it, it's going to be an investment and it's going to be a lot of work. on whether people want to go through that or not. That's the thing today. Everybody wants it easy.
Well, like, my stuff, I didn't want to drive all the way to Marion or to Mount Union, but I did because I had inventory I really needed to move. And like our little great-grandson was here a couple of days last week, we went to Baseball with me, and he said, "Oh my, you guys have got a lot of stuff, because I've got inventory in the basement." Of course, then I told my kids, "If something happens to us, you got your own Goodwill store right here." But I like being able to sell what I have to people that want something that I make. And it's no good to know that people like what I make. Yeah. That's probably why we're still on our feet at our age.
I was amazed to meet you guys last summer because, like I said, I knew you from the newspapers. I'd done 3 or 4 months of research to nominate the building your store was in to the National Register. And then April or someone said your name, I told Jeff, I said, "That's the novel. They're in all my newspaper articles from the 70s and 80s.
I have no clue that you had articles about it.
I was like, "They're real. They're still here." And what I was amazed by was I said, "Wow, you guys had that shot back in the day, but you came back for the market." And I thought that was it was a really cool to see people investing like that, especially that you had been a shop owner for all those years, and then you came back for the farmer's market. That was really neat to see.
I think for some people, it gets in your blood making people happy. You want to see people appreciate life and appreciate. And you had some people that come in and wanted to help them, teach them how to do that. And so it's just what makes life worthwhile, being able to help other people.
And then that community aspect you were talking about, Ted, I love that you put it that way about the farmers market. Like, that's actually a space where you know you're going to meet people, and otherwise it's like, you might see 3 people at Dugout. If you go to the Legion, you'll see people. If you stop in the post office, but that every Saturday,
right.
Like, see and be seen, and, you know.
And they were starting just come through just to see what was going on at their square, and they'd stop and visit.
That's what it became for us. I mean, I'm working on Jeff getting him roast and coffee again, but we lost money at the market. I think some vendors made money, but we definitely lost money because we were driving out from Columbus. But it was about the community and the conversations,
right.
And the solidarity of us all committing to be there and making something happen. Now, I think some people, I hope, made good money, and I think that the more of us who stick it out, I think the more it'll be an event. Whereas
right.
If people start packing down early and stuff like that, it looks like it's not a real thing and people aren't going to be drawn.
Right.
So.
And you had the young fellows that was there the other night. You had Kim, and you had
Andy,
and the other gentleman that was over by the old post office there on the corner.
With the truck, with the van.
You know, those three, it was good for them. Because it gives them outlets, and they enjoyed it. Tim enjoyed it tremendously because of being back to the community that he grew up in and stuff. And Tim and Andy is quite a promoter in Marion for this gardening thing. And her little with the city thinking they're doing so much with this grant, but to do anything with it, you got to spend $15,000 to get started, and you got to go to school before you can do anything, and this and that. And Tim and them have been to the meetings, even with the Ohio State professors and stuff, and they're wanting to talk to Tim and them. How are you doing this? And they've been out and looked at these offers. Right now, he's got tomatoes standing out high in that greenhouse. He's got 4,000 onion stuff that he's got to get in the ground. And we may be out there this weekend helping him do that.
After I play at Channel
39. After we play at Channel 39.
I'm not sure I know because I changed my clothes. But he manages the
he's been out there.
Oh, I think he's 55 and over. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Mid-Ohio Food Bank. The second Friday of every month, we go in there and help them because Mid-Ohio Food Bank brings in pallets of produce.
A truckload of stuff. And that's totally nothing to do with his greenhouses.
They have it on top, right?
This is the...
Well, they know him because they have a food pantry over in...
New Wilmington.
Yeah.
And so we set up out there. They bring in like 8 pallets of product and around there in front of the office. And we serve over 100 families. Not only the people in the park, but there's other people come in. And that's all part of what they... And Mid-Ohio was wanting... They come and ask him to do this. He didn't... because they wanted to get something started. And down there at the Pleasant Senior Center, they wanted nothing to do with it. And that's what they thought it would be great for, you know. And so did it. And it's become quite a hit. It's a lot of work. You go in there and get there about 8 o'clock in the morning. We do someplace between 8 and 9, and they're already working, generally, Tim and them, getting stuff around. And it's generally about 4 o'clock when we leave, and you're pretty much on your feet most of the time, just working with stuff and keeping boxes open and helping people get stuff to their car.
But you look at Tim's and Andy and that other gentleman, what they have is produce, and they have to move it. They have to have a place to move that. And where with me, if I don't sell it, I mean, we only did maybe $500 the whole summer, but with what I got, we can bring home, and if somebody shows up because they saw it, why, we'll sell it to them, but... They got to move what they have, what they've grown. So.
It's a love for Tim.
Well, I think it is Andy. Really,
well, all three of them. It is. It's a love and serving. So I know with Tim it is.
He's got that vision for co-ops. I've talked to him about that a lot. I'm really into that, about how do we co-op all the farmers together, and I grow this and you grow that. And I think what they've been trying to do is really exciting, and it's personally, I wish all this microfarm stuff in MSU, they should just take that money if they've got it and invest it in what's already happening on the ground, like what Tim and Andy are doing, rather than to recreate their own thing without any of the experiential knowledge.
Right.
That's what Tim and I are saying. You know, help grow it with the people that's already working on this and know how it's operating. Help us grow. And by us growing, other people will join and grow in. And it'll be a bigger business.
But they don't see what they're doing when they're buying local, made local. People can't see that. And it's got to happen that people support the local people, because that's what's kept their community going.
We can't exist on a service economy. We got to have it all.
And buying out of Japan and China hurts us. If you're going to buy something that you bought out of Japan or China, it hurts us. If you bought it local, it's helping our country.
The money sticks around here.
Mm-hmm.
One last question is, if each of you could import a booth or a vendor or an activity to the farmer's market this summer to make it, or next summer, to make it even better, where do you think the gap or the opportunity is in the market? What's something you would really like to see that makes the market even better? Besides an ice cream truck.
I was thinking that.
Oh, you can say that.
An ice cream truck.
Oh.
Might get kind of annoying for 3 hours of do 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 do.
The bright green van, this ice cream truck. He was going down the middle of the street the other day when we ran down. And I was surprised at seeing as much controversy as there was for a while about having them in safety.
Wait, we have an ice cream truck in Colorado?
No, in Marion. And I was really surprised to see. Because there for a while, there was nothing like that moving in Marion because of the safety factor. People was pretty much getting ready to ban them.
Kids run up to them.
Yeah. And you can understand that, but still, that's just one of those things we used to growing up as a kid. We had Riverside Dairy, which was out of Farmington, and they used to come, and that's how we got our milk. When I lived in the farmhouse down there, they delivered. You know, we'd get ice cream and stuff off of them. They had cottage cheese. He had all that, and when we would be out working in the field, maybe baling hay or something, and he'd get down the road. If he'd see us, he'd kind of go slow, and if we hailed him, he'd stop, and we'd get a fudge sickle or whatever, and, you know, that type of thing off of him. And, you know, we did that back then, and people think, well, you was doing that kind of stuff then? Or do you remember or understand that I used to bring gallon jugs of milk to your house? That's how you got it most of the time. You didn't go to the grocery store.
No, we milked the cows.
Well, we milked the cows, yeah.
We had the cooler one in the house. That's what the road took, the barn and the... But maybe antique dealers? I don't know, because a lot of people are buying those, especially those, the flat things. I know our grandkids buy that stuff, the pallets that people are buying at auctions, and they buy that stuff that's on them pallets. And I don't know, people like antiques. Whether you could get somebody interested in that.
Well, I know this, the two or three dealers.
I do. I like to go out and look through the antique things.
That had stuff there that was wooden stuff, homemade, and there was some antique, a few pieces of antique, and that seemed to be carrying quite a bit of stuff away from those places. So, it was surprising, even the jewelry stuff, the little girls that was behind us that had the old cups and stuff,
right,
that they
was making.
Yeah, they were selling. They said, you know, we make a lot. It was getting to be known. And sometimes that's part of going to these, you get to be known.
We got cups up in the cupboard. What was that when all them kids came in for competitions?
Oh, remember when the drum and bugle corps used to come in to Caledonia? That was a big thing.
And
we used to house them.
They would bring us cups and stuff. I still got them up in the cupboard.
They came from other countries?
They come in from Canada these days.
They were from Canada, yeah.
They used to come in and stay down to school. They'd house them down to school, and different people and organizations in town would help feed them. And they'd always put on in the square a demonstration when they come in there, what they do at the competition, drum duels or competition. And then what used to be funny is that's when Depot Sales was still there, and they used to, I still remember them saying that that's when you had to watch taking stuff across the border for customs. And those kids would come down here, and they sold Sedgefield jeans and stuff, and they were quality jeans. And they would buy clothes, and before they'd get to the border, they would put on like 2 and 3 pairs of pants and stuff and shirts, and that way, you know, it wasn't packed here. Well, you know, we only bought this.
They couldn't see it on the border. They would buy stuff off us, too.
They'd buy stuff off of us and things. And, it was...
I'm not sure, but what some of them didn't mail it back from what they bought, like,
some
for
of
us.
Because
so they didn't have to carry it in their things that were going to be checked.
But that was always a good time. And they did that for, I don't know how many years in Caledonia. And sponsor them down at the, they'd house them down to school. The big old buses would roll in, and then they'd have competition over at Clarendon on the football field, and then they'd go to Harding for the finish Saturday night big competition, and it was a big thing then.
I've read about that in the papers too, and I'm glad you guys reminded me. I was like, they must have had a sort of sister city relationship or something with the town in Canada.
Yeah, right.
It was,
they
knew
where they were welcome.
Yeah. They, there was a sister city, and I forget who the sister city was for Caledonia up there. It was the name, but see, we had. Yeah, a little bit of connection with Alan Farrow and Nature's, because that's where he was originally from, Canada. Him and his wife, man, that's how he got down here to Instagrow, or no, Nature's, and then he started Instagrow over here at the farm. But done a lot of things with him, too.
All kinds of activity. Well, anything else you guys want to share for the moment? Otherwise, you can always call me and we can do a part two.
I can't think of anything. Just memories.
I'm going to just close it out while he picks up the phone. So once again, we're talking with Ted and Phyllis Noggle. It is Friday, April 22nd, 2022. I'm Jessica Marguerite Holler. This is an interview for the Caledonia Public School Memories and Futures Project. Thank you guys for your time.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening.